Good evening, and welcome to the final of the 5 astronomy space lectures that you'll be hearing tonight. My name is Ray Bullock, Assistant Planning Training Coordinator, for those of you who are lucky enough not to know who I am yet. And I do have a couple of announcements to make. First of all, you might all be interested to know that it's 5 miles wide, coming at 30,000 miles per hour, and there's no place on Earth to hide. If you wonder what it is, it's the latest disaster movie called Meteor, which is opening at the theater near you on October 19th. You might want to go see it. It should be good for a chuckle. These sort of pseudo-science movies are very disappointing. Things like Star Wars and Buck Rogers are fun because they're not meant to be serious. But a thing like Meteor, or one was on TV a while back, I feel this whole Fireball or Comet or some other original name.
Comet.
Comet? Okay. Disaster movies really just don't make it. At least now we're trying to teach true science, and of course that's what you're here for, to find out what really goes on up there. I'm sure the director did not intend it to be a comedy. He probably expected it to be, well, Meteor's supposed to be a smash hit.
You can really crater disturbance when they
stuff
like that.
You hear this? He says you could crater disturbance. And you pay good money for this. Now, if you would like to get your money's worth, if you'd really like to learn something, we just happen to have this planetarium here that keeps me out of trouble. And the program is called Our Galaxy and Beyond. And we'll be taking you a little bit beyond the solar system, which is what you've been getting a lecture on in these past 5 series. The program is a little more complex than what we usually do. Talk about what our galaxy is, what other galaxies are, what we know about other galaxies, and we use just about every auxiliary in the planetarium to zip you out of the galaxy in a mere 5 minutes, and some people nearly fall out of the seat because of fast motion. But it's a neat program, and it's free. Those of you who are members don't get have no charge to come into the museum, and so it is a bargain. In addition, there are tickets still available for the Edgerton lecture, which is this Friday and Saturday night. I talked about him, I believe, 2 weeks ago. He was called Papa Flash by Jacques Cousteau, did a lot of underwater photography, perfected the strobe scope, which allowed him to do many, many fast stop-action sort of pictures. So if you would like to pick up tickets, they're available tonight at the bookshop. And now, Jim.
Thank you very much.
I want to miss this.
My own particular nomination for the most scientifically preposterous movie of the last several years was Alien, but nobody else seems to feel that way. There are more absolutely idiotic features to that plot for square inch than any other film.
I mean, it makes even Star Wars more scientifically real. Well, all that's going a little far. Anyway, that's not what you came to hear me talk about tonight either. We could have the light down back there, and the first slide shows the Pioneer 10 or 11 spacecraft. As a matter of fact, with my eagle eye, I can tell you this is 10 and not 11 because 11 has an extra magnetometer, but the artist could always reply to the magnetometer in one of these sections on the boom there that he had to cut out in order to save space. And I want to tell you tonight about the Pioneer 11 results about Saturn. Pioneer 11, however, was never intended to go to Saturn. The entire Saturn mission was a bonus. And it was not sold to the Congress, the American people, everyone, I phrase it, as a Saturn mission. It was sold as the second of 2 flights to Jupiter. And it did it, and it was spectacularly successful. And it's important to understand that although, in fact, the Saturn flight was successful, if the spacecraft had blown up a week before Saturn encounter, and we'd never gotten any data from it at all, it still would have been a 100% success and would have been for 5 years. Pioneers are basically simpler, cheaper, more rugged spacecraft than Voyagers. Therefore, if you do not know what conditions you're going into, perhaps more reliable because they can survive in a greater range of environments. On the other hand, they often don't send back data that are as good. In particular, the pictures are not anything like as good. There are some respects in which the Pioneer is getting better data than the Voyagers. And I think I already mentioned gravity data as an example. If not, I'll mention it now. So it's an oversimplification to just say a Pioneer is simpler than a Voyager, it doesn't give you as good data. But on balance, that's a true statement. And basically, the Pioneers, as their name actually kind of implies, although the reason they're called Pioneers has nothing to do with this, but it fits, as it happens. The reason they're called Pioneers goes way back in the Soviet space program. But they have a mission in which they serve as pioneers for the Voyagers. They fly out in the outer solar system and test the way, check out whether things you might think of as dangerous, as potentially dangerous, in fact are, and thereby find safe paths for the more expensive, more elaborate, and therefore more fragile Voyagers to follow. Yeah, please. Absolutely zero. The asteroid belt, for those of you who don't know the term, is the region of small bodies that orbit around the sun, as opposed to planets, which are large bodies that orbit around the sun. And we're talking here about the biggest one, which is about 500 miles across, all the way down to the smallest we can see from Earth, a quarter mile across. And of course, there will be lots more smaller ones as well. And it's called a belt because most of them, not all, but most of them are found between Mars and Jupiter. Well, we knew that the 2,000 asteroids that were known from Earth had been observed and been given names and so on were not a problem, simply because space is so immense and there are so many quadrillions of cubic miles for each one of them that the chances of an object that just goes through the asteroid belt at random hitting one of those are preposterously tiny. However, about the chance of a meteorite demolishing Phoenix, Arizona, as a matter of fact. But what we also knew is that the asteroids that we see today, with the exception of the four or five largest, are collision fragments. That is, they bang into one another and they break apart. And you say, now wait a minute, you just got through telling us collisions are not a danger, now you're telling us they collide with each other. See, the asteroids stay out there, whereas the spacecraft simply went through one. If you just go through once, or if you watch an asteroid over a period of a few years, the chances of a collision are negligible. But if you give them billions of years worth of a chance, they eventually get around to doing it. And there are various arguments that I haven't got time to go into that they are in fact collisions. That almost all the asteroids you see today are collision fragments. We also do from laboratory simulations of such collisions. You bang a couple of rocks together in a high vacuum at several miles a second and see what happens. That the number of small fragments produced is bigger than the number of big fragments produced. In other words, we figure there's going to be a lot of dust out there. It might sandblast the spacecraft to smithereens. And there's only one way to find out. Send the spacecraft through and see if it survives. Well, the weird thing, to finally get around to answering the question, is that not only did it survive, but the amount of dust in the asteroid belt is actually smaller per cubic mile than the amount in the space near the Earth. And to this day, nobody really knows the reason why. There are several mechanisms we can think of that would selectively remove dust from the asteroid belt, but nobody really thought of them before the discovery was made, and it really kind of shook everybody up when it was discovered. So there's a fine example of the way the Pioneers served as pathfinders to clear the way for the Voyagers, which then could be targeted to go through the asteroid belt with every sure set, and of course they did. But as you will see, there were other dangers out there that the Pioneers tried to check out, which in fact turned out to be even more dangerous than they expected. Pioneer 11 was the second of these two spacecraft launched, and as I say, it went to Jupiter, but it turned out it was able to fly past Jupiter in such a way as to go on to Saturn, and that was a bonus. Likewise, Voyager 2 has the opportunity, when it gets to Saturn, of flying past it at a particular place, such that it can be sent on to Uranus, and maybe even Neptune. And that also is a bonus. But the question was, would space do this? Now, the rings of Saturn, I'll say more about them later on, but for now what you've got to understand is, they are not the flat plates. They look like in a picture like this, of course, a negative. They are millions and millions of individual particles of probably native ice, at least rock covered by ice, which are orbiting around Saturn in the same orbit. And although it looks as though there is no material in there, there's no material out there, detailed observations have shown that in fact there is. Pierre Garin,
Fred astronomer in 1969 took an overexposed picture, which seemed to indicate there was a gap there, which is called the Garak gap, and then there was some material extending in a good part, at least a part of the way to the planet, probably all the way. And that's not surprising. There are various gravitational forces owing to effects of the other moon, the sun, the fact that Saturn is not particularly, perfectly spherical, and radiation pressure. You know, the sunlight actually emits a little bit of pressure, and an object that is moving through this radiation will be affected by that pressure in such a way as to get dragged inward. And finally, I think I mentioned these last two mechanisms last time we talked about the rings of Jupiter. Well, the time before last, we talked about the rings of Jupiter. There is a magnetic drag effect. A particle, a proton or electron, a charged particle, in the radiation belt, hits the ring particle. And please note, I'm using the word particle there in two different senses, or two different size scales. When you talk about a subatomic particle, you mean protons, electrons, and neutrons, and other subatomic particles, things that atoms are made of, or things that they can decay into, things that atoms are made of. When you talk about a ring particle, you're talking about an object that is enormously bigger, although still microscopic in many cases. That is to say, one of these chunks of ice, in the case of Saturn, rock in the case of Jupiter and Uranus, which are orbiting around the planet forming rings. Okay, so a ring particle and a sort of subatomic particle, and if it's small enough, considerable periods of time go by when it's a sort of only one subatomic particle. So there's an equal number of protons which are positively charged and electrons that are negatively charged out there. Eventually, over time, the ring particle will not be charged by these absorptions. But if it's small enough, it can absorb a proton, and it may be years before it finally gets around to hitting an electron absorbing that. And during all that time, it's positively charged. Well, the fact that it has this charge, and it's in Saturn's rotating magnetic field, turns out to have an effect which inside a certain distance will drag it inward toward the planet, and outside that certain distance will push it out or away from the planet. The difference being whether the magnetic field, which rotates once every 10 hours, same as Saturn does, is going around faster than the ring particle, in which case the net effect is to push it outwards, or slower than the ring particle, in which case the net effect is to push it inwards. Okay? And so it's not surprising that there would be material slowly migrating in from the rings of Saturn and falling into the planet. The question was, would it be safe to send a spacecraft in there? Most of the pioneer scientists wanted to do that. And this is a diagram which does not show what the orbit looks like. It's not a possible shape for an orbit. The planet is over there. What this shows you is a projection of the three-dimensional orbit on a two-dimensional space. They have shown you the distance from the planet correctly, and the distance above or below the point of the ring correctly at each point, but what they've ignored is the fact that they're in the third dimension, that you've got to go 360 degrees around the planet. Okay? So this is showing you a plot of where the spacecraft would have been with respect to the rings from the planet at each moment, and these are Greenwich times. Most of the scientists wanted to do that, and to try to be as safe as possible, they've gone through the Garak gap, made a very, very close approach to Saturn in there, very apt to be close to the approach of the planet, and then if they survived, gone out like so. Chances would have been very good, it was generally believed, they would not survive. But most of the pioneer scientists would rather have had that, even if it destroyed the spacecraft. And the reason is, they wanted to get those close data from Saturn. And Pioneer 11 is near enough to the end of any useful life that it might have that you're not going to be too terribly sad if it's destroyed at this point. It's already giving you far more than it was ever intended to do. A whole Saturn trip was a bonus in any case. Whereas the Voyager, the next spacecraft to get to Saturn, that is not true of. They will have a very long useful lifetime after the Saturn encounter. You don't want to hazard them in the slightest by doing this kind of kamikaze mission. And so the only chance that you would have had for a long, long time to get the closed-in data on Saturn's magnetic field, for example, would have been to do this mission, even though it probably would have destroyed the spacecraft. NASA, however, overruled the desire of the Pioneer scientists and decided to fly Pioneer 11 in a trajectory which you notice had become nearly as close to Saturn. It went right under the rings and got better data about the rings, in fact, and this one would have somewhat better data, not a whole lot different. But the major point is, there was reason to believe, from a gadget called a densitometer, it doesn't matter all that much for our purposes what that means, there was reason to believe that there was material out about the rings, the main rings, as well. It's a semantic question whether you want to say, if there's a little bit of material out there, whether you want to say that's another ring which is very thin, or that is debris outside the rings. And, you know, some reporters chose one description, some chose the other, and I can tell you, in my case, I kept seesawing back and forth between them, and that was all the night, whichever is more convenient. But, in fact, this region outside the rings has been given a name, it's called the E ring, and this region inside the main ring has been given a name, it's called the D ring. So the question was, for Voyager 2, if it was to go on to Uranus, it had to get very close to the outer edge of the main ring, the A ring. You can't tell from this picture because it's all overexposed when we show you the St. D ring, but the rings are divided into three rings, three main rings, and they're called A, B, and C in order in which the planet. And it's all very nice and simple bands, you know, because A is the first letter of the alphabet, B is the second, C is the third, and then if your adversary is another one inside, well, obviously it's D. And bam! Bam! They discovered one outside the A ring. You know, this very, very thin material. And what do you call it? There's no letter before A. So they picked E. As you will see, it's going to steadily get worse. Because Pioneer 11 discovered two new rings. One of them just outside the A ring, and of course the interior to most of the E ring, but we got to call it the F ring. And then the G ring, still further out. But the G ring may actually turn out to be the same thing as the E ring when all was said and done, because it was observed by a different method. Before the G ring was announced, when we had the sequence B, C, B, A, F, E, it got to be, for a few days, a popular pastime in the press room among the reporters and some of the scientists to come up with mnemonic sentences which start, whose words started with the letters B, C, D, C, B, A, F, E. For example, do Catholics begin as failed Episcopalians was one. Dutiful communist bureaucrats of horror free enterprise was one of mine. Dallas Pop be acid preached enthusiastically another one. Of course, there were a whole lot of fake in jokes. For example, Dale Cruikshank, who was one of the astronomers on the Pioneer Imaging team, Dale Cruikshank believes asteroids formed early. I came up with Dedekind chariot believers are fooled easily. And there's one for Larry Coleman, the project scientist on Pioneer Venus. Dr. Coleman's Brooklyn accent forbids elegance, and so forth. Anyway, we're offering a prize for the best new one that you can come up with, but you've got to incorporate G now, too, see? And entry should be sent to me with a cash donation. And no, entry should be sent to me, and the first prize will be a genuine Apollo 13 moon rock, and the second prize will be a ride on the Goodrich Voyager. Okay, for those of you who didn't get that, 13 didn't land and there is no Goodrich Blimp. All right, good year. Anyway, getting back to some semblance of the real universe. So the decision was made by NASA in Washington, overruling the desires of the Pioneer scientists, to fly through the ring plane in this hypothetical E-ring out there at the very distance from Saturn, where Voyager 2 will have to go if, in fact, it goes on to Uranus. And you see that's close into the A ring, and there was fear that the density of the E ring might get greater and greater as you move in, which is very reasonable, and therefore the Voyager 2 might have been destroyed. Well, I think that was a very, very bad decision. I am sometimes accused by people who don't know me too well of being simply blindly in favor of space exploration, and certainly that article in the Free Press bent, that some of you may unfortunately have read about me, bent over backwards to create that impression to the point where I was very unhappy at the number of quotes out of context that he had to use to achieve that. However, here's the, where they get that impression is when NASA does something right, which is most of the time, actually, I point it out, and a lot of reporters aren't supposed to do that, they have the feeling only negative news is news. But when NASA blows it, I say so too, and I think this is a case where they made a very, very bad decision, and more importantly, a lot of Pioneer scientists think that. Because the feeling is that the Voyager 2 Uranus option is a bonus, in the same way as the Pioneer 11 Saturn encounter is. And yes, you can argue that this kind of thing is in the Pioneer tradition, checking it out in Voyager first, but a lot of us felt that at that point, if not sooner, Voyager ought to be required to take its own chances, and that we could have gotten more overall useful scientific data by flying in there through the Garak Gap and making a close approach. However, irrespective of my opinion or anybody else's opinion, the Islam was chosen, and certainly there was the fear that the spacecraft might have been destroyed by hitting a ring particle across the ring plane, and the way it did it was, it went in, reached a certain close approach to Saturn, and then of course it's actually over on the other side of the planet, but they don't show that in this kind of diagram. It came out and crossed the ring plane a second time at that very same place. Now, again, it seems to me that was kind of overkill. If you had to have an outside crossing, why not do a trajectory in which you get both? You come in, you have a slanted trajectory. It's got to be symmetrical around the planet. But there's no law that says the line of symmetry of the orbit has to have anything to do with the line of symmetry of the ring. You come in, you do your outside approach to the Voyager people like so, you go in under the ring, and then you come back up out again like so. See, and the line of symmetry is sticking out at an angle like that. And that would have been possible, but they didn't even do that. They had two ring plane crossings at the same distance to Pioneer that Voyager 2 will need to go if it goes to Europe. And the spacecraft survived both of them. So the real tragedy, if it had been destroyed, would have not been the loss of Pioneer 11 particularly. It's true that we would have lost the close-in data under the ring, the close-in data Saturn, but we still would have gotten most of the data further on out there. And Pioneer 11 was near the end of its useful life anyway. No, the real tragedy would have been the loss of a completely different planet on a completely different spacecraft. If Pioneer 11 had been destroyed, it would have meant that the Voyager people would have retargeted their spacecraft so that it would not go with that place, and therefore so it would have been able to go on to Europe. And to put it another way, a positive way instead of a negative way, what we won as a result of Pioneer 11 surviving was, in fact, Uranus on Voyager 2, and there's every reason to assume now that Voyager 2 will in fact go there. Pioneer 11, as I started to say, is the second of two such spacecraft. This is the launch of Pioneer 11. It was in 1972, the spacecraft got to Jupiter in 1974, and that's an Atlas Centaur rocket, the same kind that was used in later years to launch the Pioneer Venus spacecraft. Pioneer Saturn, as it was named after it went to Jupiter, or Pioneer 11, either term is usable, flew from the Earth to Jupiter. I'm sorry, I thought it was launched in 1972. Either that's wrong or I'm wrong. Anybody happen to know offhand? I swear it was 72. Well, okay, the people that, this is a NASA diagram, the people that prepare these aren't infallible, but they're usually pretty accurate, so I guess that was wrong. Well, I just learned something from my own lecture. All right, gee, all right, so I'll pay for a ticket this time. Spacecraft flew from the Earth to Jupiter, made a very, very close approach to Jupiter, and made an angle approach to Jupiter. It went over the poles, and remember I showed you those polar pictures a couple of weeks ago, and that meant that it went flying up above the flat plane that is defined by the orbits of the planet. The only spacecraft that had ever done so, and at its highest, which was halfway between Jupiter and Saturn, it was as far above the plane as the Earth is from the Sun. And that number I happen to know, so the fact that it looks a little bit bigger than the diagram is an artistic error. This angle, in fact, should be 11 degrees. And then it came back down to Saturn and flew past Saturn on September 1st of this year, so that the entire journey was over half a billion miles out to Jupiter and then a billion and a half miles from Jupiter completely around the Sun, 180 degrees around the solar system, and an additional half a billion miles farther out. Some of you may be aware that now the outer planets are in an arrangement. Jupiter has moved around so that it's there. And the outer planets are in such an arrangement that you can launch a spacecraft from the Earth to Jupiter and have it fly past Saturn, and Uranus would be out there when the spacecraft got there, and Neptune would be over there, and Pluto would be over there, and so you could actually fly a single spacecraft at all five of those planets. A chance like that is called a grand tour. It happens only once every 175 years, which means that the last such chance was when Thomas Jefferson was president of the U.S., and the next one will be in the middle of the 22nd century. One of the many wonderful things that President Nixon, remember him? Did for the country is that he killed the U.S. Grand Tour Opportunity in 1971 or 72. I'm not too confident of my recollections of dates back then all of a sudden, in order to save an amount of money that is less than one third of what we spent on chewing gum during the same period. And as a result, NASA had to substitute the Voyagers, which are taking advantage of the Grand Tour configuration to do a restricted mission, Jupiter and Saturn for sure, if they're to be considered successful, and if we're lucky it all goes well, Uranus and Neptune, Noble for Pluto. Well, the Voyagers then are a sort of four-man Grand Tour. If all goes well, we'll get everything we would have had on the Grand Tour. Well, we won't have everything we would have had on the Grand Tour. We would have had more elaborate instruments, there would have been more spacecraft, therefore we could have done more things each planet and so forth, but at least we'll get some of it if all goes well.
The first one to add the question.
Okay, please. Just yell a question or jam or something.
Okay.
It's almost impossible for me to see you there in the dark.
All right. Between Saturn and Uranus, there's a little meteor called Cole.
Tyrus. Cole was the guy that discovered it.
Is it going to go past it?
No. I don't think the orbit of Chiron is known well enough that you'd be able to calculate that. And of course, it was not part of the mission plan because Chiron hadn't even heard of when the Voyagers were on the drawing board. But it's asking a little too much for Chiron to happen to be in the right position too. And you see, the reason you're able to do this Grand Tour thing is you're using the gravity of each planet to speed you up. And Chiron being so tiny, meteor is not a bad description. Asteroid, I think, is probably your best word. It's the only asteroid of any size that is outside the asteroid belt. And this is the object that a couple years ago, was discovered by Charles Cole, and a lot of the news media described it as a tenth planet, which was garbage. It was obvious at the point that it wasn't big enough to be a planet, let alone now. It was obvious immediately that it was not. It's still a very exciting object because it is the only asteroid of any size that we know of that has an orbit that's outside the asteroid belt, and one of the very, very few asteroids that has an orbit that's exclusively outside the asteroid belt. Even the ones that can travel outside the asteroid belt usually at least travel through it, and so you can say, well, they used to have belt orbits and then gravitational perturbations changed their orbit a bit. And, you know, for all we know, there's a whole new asteroid belt out there between Saturn and Uranus that we didn't even realize was there. There are certain respects in which Pluto is rather like Chiron. Pluto is bigger, but it has the same weird kind of orbit. Both Chiron and Pluto have orbits that cross under or over, whichever way you want to look at it, the orbit of the next inner planet. We say over or under. I mean, if you drew a diagram that was looking down on it from on top instead of a perspective diagram like this, it would look as though they crossed. Actually, they're crossing in the way that a bridge crosses a highway. So they can't collide. But Pluto can come closer to the Sun than Neptune. In fact, it is now closer to the Sun than Neptune, has been since January this year, and will be through March 1999. Chiron, at its closest to the Sun, can come closer than Saturn. And there are some other respects in which they're similar, too, but this is not a Pluto lecture. Say that at some other time. But the answer is no, sorry. We're not even getting good pictures of the outermost moon of Saturn. For much the same reason, you know, it's just so tiny, its orbit is not well known, it's just too hard to target. We're getting good pictures of the inner moon of Saturn, that's the best we can do. Okay, so the thing is that this Grand Tour configuration, which by the way is not a lineup, I'm getting so sick and tired of hearing that the outer planets are going to line up in 1982. They are not. In fact, it's mathematically impossible for them ever to do so. There are relationships among their periods, every time they take a go around the Sun, which make that impossible. They are not lined up, and I guarantee that they are not going to cause earthquakes in 1982 or any other year, which is the other idiocy that we've been hearing about. I also guarantee that there will be many earthquakes in 1982, as there are every year. On the average, there is a major earthquake, Richter magnitude 6 or above, every 3 weeks. And the point is, most of them are not reported because they aren't news. You know, they happen out in the middle of the ocean somewhere, nobody's hurt, and they're just not news, you know, for general purposes. Geologists know about them. I predict that in 1982 they will be reported, and millions of people will go to their graves believing that there was an unusual number of earthquakes in 1982 and that it was caused by the supposed planetary lineup, a thing which will not have happened, and that fact will not be reported. You heard it here first. Okay, in any case, Chris Bretton says what's really going to happen, see, is everything east of the San Andreas Fault is going to
flight into the Atlantic. Her point is, if you're going to do pseudoscience, at least be creative about it. Buy your way through that now.
Or move west of the San Andreas Fault.
Okay, I'd like to point out, though, that Pioneer 11 did not use the Grand Tour alignment. In fact, it did it the hardest possible way. It went from Jupiter to Saturn, which were at positions practically as far from each other as they can ever get. And the only reason this was possible is that Pioneer 10 had found out a way to get close enough to Jupiter that not its rings, which weren't known yet, but its radiation belt would pose... The radiation belt gets denser and denser as you go in, but Pioneer 10 found a way to go through the radiation belt in such a way as you go real close to Jupiter and nevertheless don't get much radiation, and I'll tell you about that later, and that cleared the way to go off to Saturn. Little did we know at the time that that trajectory took Pioneer 11 through the ring. It flew through the ring and we didn't even know it had happened until 5 years later when Voyager 1 finally discovered the ring. And they went back to the old data, and the old Pioneer 11 Jupiter data, and lo and behold, at just the right point, Pioneer 11 registered a meteorite impact. A little one, a little dust grain, and that's all that happened to it. So there were a lot of us that really kind of thought that the whole question about whether it would survive and pass through the E-ring was kind of exaggerated anyway. But there's only one way to be sure. The E-ring could have been different from the place in Jupiter's system where it flew through. I'd point out also, I don't know if everybody realizes that one of these planetary spacecraft does not fire its rockets the entire way out, okay? That big Atlas Centaur rocket is used for the first few tens of minutes of the flight and discarded. You give it all its velocity, all its kinetic energy at the very beginning of the flight, and then it coasts for 7 years in this case through the various gravitational fields that it's encountered. And so Pioneer 11, make that 6.5 years, Pioneer 11 flew over 2 billion miles on the impulse given to it in the first few tens of minutes of the flight by burning 42,000 gallons of rocket fuel and oxidizer on the Atlas Centaur, which means the Pioneer 11 achieved a grand total of 47,700 miles per gallon. This is the way the flight would have looked as seen from Earth if you could see the trajectory against space there. This is the inbound crossing of the ring plane. They've drawn only the A, B, and C rings, the major rings there. Closest approach by coincidence happened just about the time that it disappeared behind Saturn's seen from Earth. It was hidden back there for about 2 hours, and then it crossed the plane of the rings on the way out. From the inbound crossing to the outbound crossing took only 4 hours, and that'll give you an idea of how fast that thing was going, because that is a distance somewhat greater than the distance from the Earth to the Moon, and it did it in 4 hours. Now, what I'm going to show you next is, I should explain what Earth occultation, Sun occultation, or I already told you that. Ever use those terms? Okay, Earth occultation, I just told you about, but I didn't tell you, use the name. It means it disappears behind the planet and sees from the Earth, which means that at the point where it disappears, the radio signals are having to pass through the atmosphere of the planet, and that distorts them in ways that tell you things about the atmosphere of the planet. It's a risky maneuver. It means that you are losing contact with the spacecraft for 2 hours just at the time when you're flying past the planet. But if you've got enough confidence in the spacecraft, and that tape recorder, which of course has to record all the data that it's picking up back there, a tape recorder which had been flying for 6 years and which, like everything else on Pioneer 11, was designed to last for 2 years, if you have that kind of confidence, Earth occultation is a useful maneuver. Also, there is sun occultation, which means that you fly in the shadow of the planet, fly behind the planet and see from the sun, which means that at the most critical part of the mission, you suddenly allow a temperature drop of about 200 degrees Fahrenheit on the spacecraft. But if you have confidence it will survive that, that also is a useful data gathering method. You look at the sun through the atmosphere of the planet and see what the atmosphere does to the sunlight and transmit those data back from the spacecraft. What I have now is a really remarkable computer-generated film, which was done by a bunch of people at JPL, whom the major one is Dr. James Lynn.
and he was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, attended all my programs back there, and so you see what this sort of thing can lead to. He's gone out to JPL and done this absolutely staggering computer animation of what this whole flyby would have looked like if you could have ridden along on the spacecraft. You started out looking next to the spacecraft, and so as you can see what the spacecraft looks like, and then the field of view comes in like so. The spacecraft sort of merges with the viewer. At that point, your point of view is on the spacecraft, and you look at what the spacecraft would have seen as it goes through these various events. And I would like to show that film now, Ray, if you please. And you've got to realize, everything you see here is correct. All of the stars are properly plotted in the right positions in the background. None of this is fake. That represents the sun. The spacecraft comes in rapidly from the west, rotates, and of course the time here is all speeded up. It rotates actually about once every 5 minutes. Constellations Capricornus, there's Sagittarius, there's Scorpius, and there's Aries. Okay, Saturn comes into view with its moons going around it. That was Enceladus, that's Tethys, that's Mimas. That's Mimas. And we're moving in now towards the planet. This is speeded up a great deal. The rings are appearing flatter and flatter, and at the moment that they appear in a straight line, that is when we cross the plane of the rings. That right there. Now we go in for that spectacular flight under the rings. It's 2,000 miles below them. There's Cassini's division, there is the B ring, there is the Garrard division, there is the D ring. Shadow of the planet rapidly moves around. As it overtakes us, we enter sun occultation right there. There is the other shadow. We'll be in sun occultation for about 2 hours. Move around under the rings, moving back up. That's closest approach. Now we exit sun occultation. There's the sun, there's the earth next to it. We go under the rings again, second ring plane crossing, and on the way out, we look at various moons moving around. That one is Mimas, that one is Enceladus. That's Mimas, that's Enceladus, that was Tethys and Dione. Our field of view now looks over to see the big moon Titan, which is coming rapidly into view, a very red object. Actually, nobody knew what it looked like close up, but Jim didn't do a very bad job of it. It shows a little bit less detail than you're seeing there. We fly past Titan at a closest approach of about a quarter of a million miles, about the same distance as the moon is from the Earth. That is not a close approach by, say, Voyager standards. Pan back, and spacecraft comes into view again and starts rotating. Moons of Jupiter going around. Mimas just flashed out as it went into the shadow. Film was released to all the TV networks. Not one of them used it.
56 did.
PBS did. PBS did a fine job with this mission, none of the others did. Okay, before I start showing you Saturn pictures for real, the good news is I've got this spectacular film. The bad news is it's by far the most visually spectacular thing you're going to see in this lecture. The real pictures aren't nearly as good. And there's several reasons for that. I want you to realize that although these Pioneer pictures are never going to be anything like as good as the Voyager pictures of Saturn we'll get from Voyager 1 next year, close approach in November, from Voyager 2 the year after that, close approach in August, nevertheless, the Pioneer pictures are going to be considerably better. But it takes a while to get them that way. The so-called camera on Pioneer 11 is not really a camera at all. It's a gadget which can scan up and down across the at various places across the planet. And remember, the spacecraft is spinning. And so as the spacecraft spins around, the spacecraft is this way, the camera can paint a line across the planet, can look at one line after another across the planet, and slowly build up an image. And it takes several hours to finish building up an image. Well, during that time, the spacecraft has moved, the planet has rotated, and so forth and so on. And for that and other reasons, it takes a considerable amount of computer processing on the ground to reconstruct what the picture would have looked like if he had been there with a Voyager-style television camera or with a film camera and taken a snapshot. You can do it. It's just that it takes several months, and so far, we do not have those pictures. To give you an illustration of what I'm talking about, another way of saying what I was talking about is this imaging system achieves low cost and high reliability and simplicity at the price of sending back data in only partially digested form. okay? And so you get the data eventually, but you gotta do it, you gotta wait for the computer process. Here is an illustration of what I mean. Those are raw, Pioneer 10 actually, but it's the same system, pictures of Jupiter. Here is what they look like, here's what one of those pictures look like when they get through being taken care of. Now, of course, it's not anything like as good as a Voyager picture, but it's an awful lot better than that. And now, at this point, all I have is pictures of Saturn that look like this. Well, it was a little better because there have been advances in the picture receiving and immediate first-look computer processing since then. So they're not going to look quite as miserable, but they're not going to look as good as they will eventually. However, there's something I've got to point out, and that is you're never going to see a picture of Saturn that looks like this. First of all, Saturn simply does not have, this is the Voyager Pioneer 11 discovery, Saturn simply does not have all of this contrast between white and dark and between one color and another that you see on Jupiter. The reason that you can trace the individual cloud features on Jupiter is there is a lot of contrast between them. Saturn doesn't have that, apparently because Saturn, being farther from the sun, therefore colder, has a very high layer above the main clouds of thin ammonia crystals, frozen ammonia haze, which blurs and softens your view of what is underneath. Well, that can be taken care of to some extent by artificially jacking up the contrast. You remember we had to do that on the Venus pictures, both from Mars and from Pioneer Venus orbiter. But it's still not going to look like this, even if you artificially increase the contrast, because Saturn simply does not have all these weather systems. Now, that may mean that some people will be disappointed in the Saturn pictures, but it's a very important finding. It means that Saturn has a Jupiter-type atmosphere that is simpler than the atmosphere of Jupiter. And so by studying it, we ought to be able to get some insights that enable us to understand Jupiter's atmosphere better. So it's good news. As it so often happens in science, negative results are important discoveries too, but if you don't realize that, you may be disappointed for the wrong reasons. So, enough ado, let's show you some pictures of Saturn. Oh yeah, the other problem was, Saturn, for reasons that I think I talked about in this course already, was almost exactly behind the sun and seen from the Earth when we got there. Again, because we just, you know, it was a bonus. We had the opportunity to go there, even though it was a non-nominal time, so we went. Sun emits a lot of radio noise, and the signals were extremely faint as it was. The signals received on Earth from Pioneer 11 were the same strength as those received from the surface of Venus from the Pioneer Venus from the Pioneer Venus probe, and those were about 1/100 of 1 billionth of 1 billionth of a watt. And I think I already quoted the number, but perhaps it bears repeating, that the spacecraft had continued transmitting at that strength for the entire 4.5 billion year history of the solar system, and you saved up all the energy you received on the Earth. You would now have enough electricity to light a 7.5 watt Christmas tree bulb for 1/5000th of a second. And that is the strength of the signals on which these data were sent back. Well, it turned out that the sun got very noisy just as they got there. The sun varied its activity. And unfortunately, it picked the wrong time to do it. Not too surprising, we're coming up on a solar activity maximum. But the result of the solar interference with Saturn so nearly behind the sun to see from Earth was they had to send back the data at only half the rate they were hoping to, which is to say they could take only half as many data. So each of these pictures had to be chopped in half at the last moment. And basically what you lost was the right-hand half of each picture. So, let's show you the best picture probably of Saturn from the mission in the raw form, in the non-computer process form. That is the moon Titan, the only planet-sized moon that Saturn has. Jupiter, if you'll recall, has four. Saturn has one that is about the size of the planet Mercury, considerably bigger than Pluto, but it is most interesting because it's the only moon in the entire solar system that has any kind of decent atmosphere. You know, I told you Io has a very, very little atmosphere, about 1/10 billionth as dense as the Earth on the day side, and then it freezes out at night. But Titan has an atmosphere that is at least as dense as that of Mars. And up until a few months ago, we thought that it might even have been as dense as Earth. And if it was made of the right gases, it could have trapped heat so effectively that Titan, even a billion miles from the sun, could have been hot enough to support Earth-type life. I've told you about the greenhouse effect, Well, we suspected there was a lot of hydrogen in the atmosphere on Titan, and if there was, hydrogen has a really good, really strong greenhouse effect, and it could have given you a surface temperature if there was enough of it, and if it was in fact hydrogen, as high as that of the Earth. Well, Pioneer 11 measured the temperature of Titan. At first, it was believed that the data had been lost because of interference as they were being transmitted, not from the sun, but from a very much nearer object, namely a Soviet early warning satellite, Cosmos 1124. And by the way, if you haven't been keeping track of what the Russians have been doing in space, and if you have, it's kind of a miracle since our media don't report that even less than they report what we do, that name means exactly what it sounds like. That is the 1,124th satellite that the Russians have launched in that one particular series. Not as though it's the 1,124th satellite they've launched, but in that particular series, they were up to 1124, and in fact, they're now considerably beyond that. Well, in fact, the whole point about the interference is not the Russians are bad guys who are trying to blot out our data transmission. They have been, in fact, very good about turning off their satellite when asked. The problem this time was nobody asked them. The satellite had only been launched 3 days earlier, and unfortunately, nobody in NASA realized in time that its orbit was such that it would be going over the Madrid tracking station in Spain at the time that the spacecraft would be trying to send back these data. And there is no way you could have expected the Russians to know that. There are probably only a few hundred people on Earth that knew the data were coming back at that particular time. You know, I mean, any of the reporters could have found out if we bothered to ask, but I certainly didn't. I wasn't interested in the schedule down to that kind of level of detail, and I don't think anybody else did either, certainly nobody the Russians read. So, in fact, the satellite did its thing. But it turned out that, in fact, the Titan data did not come back quite at the time that we thought they were going to. Just so when we send the Voyagers out there, we'll be able to do very much fancier things and be able to do much more precise targeting. And so now we're going to know where Titan is in the course, but we didn't for Pioneer 11. Well, the infrared radiometer, which measures the temperature of Titan, is a gadget with a fixed angle of look. So Titan simply passes through its field of view at some point, and what that point is determined by A, where Titan is in orbit, and B, exactly what the trajectory of the spacecraft was. The upshot of it turned out to be that the data were sent back a little bit later than the best theoretical prediction, just at a time when the interference from Cosmos 1124 had not completely disappeared, but had gotten down to a low enough level that we lost only about 20% of the Titan data. And that was not enough to make them very significantly degraded. That's the good news. The bad news is the temperature of Titan was 325 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Now, that in itself doesn't rule out life on Titan, because Titan is totally covered by red smog of some sort, a thin red haze of clouds, or maybe a thick red haze of clouds, in some ways analogous to those of Venus, but not made of the same substances. And the way this particular instrument works, it measures temperatures at the cloud tops or even a bit above in the atmosphere. So you could say, well, maybe the cloud tops are 20 miles, 30 miles above the ground, which is reasonable. A lot of people do think that. And the ground is going to be a great deal warmer. And from the Pioneer 11 data, you can't rule that out. However, within the last few months, a new radio telescope called the Very Large Array in New Mexico has been able to, for the first time in history, has been able to make temperature observations of Titan, despite the fact that sitting right next to it in the sky is this big, glaring, hot thing, Saturn. You see, it's the first radio telescope that's been able to pull Titan's radiation out of that huge amount of Saturn. And it got a temperature on the surface, and it is no more than a few tens of degrees of Fahrenheit hotter. So, in fact, there is not Earth-like life on Titan, unless you want to cling to the very, very thin hope that for some reason that single observation from the VLA is wrong, but nobody really believes that. It was done by very careful, capable people with very, very good equipment. So, does that mean Titan is interesting? Of course not. I guarantee you there's some fantastic meteorology in this atmosphere, the only moon in the solar system that has an atmosphere like that, and I guarantee there's going to be some very, very exotic geology down on the surface, because this world is made of things that are so different from anything we've seen up to this point. What it does mean, though, is if you're open for life in the solar system, you can trash Titan off your list. There are still several possibilities.
maybe Saturn, maybe Jupiter, although for reasons I told you last time, it's not likely. Mars is still definitely not ruled out, and you still got possibilities of Uranus, especially Neptune, which has its own internal heat source in the same way as Jupiter and Saturn do. The weird thing is Uranus seems not to. Uranus is not hot inside. Neptune is, and yet they're supposed to be twins. And I have been suspecting for quite some time that, in fact, they're not, because I don't know any other two worlds in the solar system that are. And if we were trying to observe the Earth and Venus from the distance of Uranus or Neptune, all we could tell would be what we can tell about Uranus and Neptune observing from the distance of the Earth. That is, number one, they're both the same size, and number two, as far as you can tell, they're both totally covered by clouds. You would not be able to see the Earth, the land masses and the oceans on Earth, the kind of resolution we have with our best telescopes in the distance of Uranus and Neptune. So stick around. I suspect you're going to find it very different from one another. In any case, I think you can see that there is not very much banding on Saturn, and what there is of it is a good deal simpler than what you see on Jupiter. I'm going to tell you what Saturn looks like, and not all of this is obvious in this particular picture. Remember that the imaging team has the advantage of computer printouts of the individual data that make up this picture, and on those you can see some things that are not obvious on the picture. So I'm just going to have to ask you to sit back, look at the picture, but if you don't see something I'm describing, you're not crazy, it's not your eyes, it's just that I've got access to more data than you've seen here in this one picture. First of all, of course, these are the rings, and there's a shadow, and I will tell you in a moment why the rings look so weird. If you are used to pictures of the rings of Saturn, you're probably sitting there thinking, what is the matter with those rings? There seem to be too many of them, they seem to be too narrow, and the gaps between them seem to be too numerous. I'll get to that, but I got a better picture to illustrate that. But I wanted to point out this is the shadow of the rings on the planet. Now what you have is a bright yellow equatorial region extending up to about latitude 20 degrees on either side of the equator, and that is the coldest cloud tops on Saturn, and therefore the highest cloud tops probably. In the polar region, you have a rich brown, is the expression used by these people that do the computer printouts, collar around the pole, and the very polar region is blue. And probably that is readily scattering. In other words, blue sky seems to be outside, in the same way as we saw in, for example, polar regions of Jupiter. In between the polar collar, and by the way, all this description I'm giving is true of both hemispheres, in between the polar collar and the north edge or the south edge of the equatorial region, there is something you don't see on Jupiter, and that is a whole lot of very narrow, bright and dark stripes, which don't show very much contrast between each other, between the brightest and the dark ones, and are even narrower than you ever see on Jupiter. Conspicuous by their absence are spots, whole storms. Very, very occasionally, such a spot is seen from Earth. And the whole history of Saturn observations from the Earth, only 9 of those spots have been seen. We can now tell you where they are. They are at the boundary between the equatorial region and the place where the narrow belts and zones begin, or they are at the south edge or the north edge of one of those brown polar caps, polar colors. That, so far, is about all I can tell you about meteorology in Saturn, and the bottom line is it's somewhat similar to Jupiter, we think, but it's a great deal simpler.
Are those 9
storms
around?
No. They're like, they tend to be a little longer wide than the average ones on Jupiter, but of course we see only the very biggest ones from Earth. The last I heard about Pioneer Saturn, and I have not been able to follow up on this, it's beginning to look as though there were a few small spots, too small to have been seen on, from Earth, in the Pioneer 11 pictures, but nothing like the number that you see in Jupiter. Which is kind of a pain, because it means they're not going to be able to determine rotation periods, winds, and so forth. You know, you do that by measuring the speeds of spot motion. And, nature doesn't always give you what you want. Although a Pioneer does not take pictures that are as good as those in Voyager, it does a better job of measuring gravity, for example. And I talked about that, didn't I? So I remember explaining that to you. You sure? I didn't?
You mentioned that fact.
I didn't tell you why? Okay, well the reason is the Pioneer stabilizes itself in space. And, you know, any spacecraft has got this problem, keeping itself in the right orientation in space. Pioneer does it in a really brute force method by simply spinning. okay? And you know what the gyroscopic effect is?
Well, that's good in some respects.
Obviously, it doesn't contribute to the quality of your pictures. And for example, when we went under the rings in that close flyby there, we didn't get any pictures of the rings. Because, you know, the spacecraft would spin and the thing would do one line across the rings. And the next time it spun around, the next line would be way down the ring. We got data. The instrument was working. It just wasn't working in the imaging mode. You got the data on these narrow scans across the rings, and that will tell you some important things about them. What pioneers are really big on compared to Voyager is particles and fields. That is, subatomic particles in interplanetary space and in the magnetic field regions of Jupiter and Saturn, for example, the radiation belts around Jupiter, and also things like magnetic fields. And for that, a spinning spacecraft in some ways is better, because you're looking in every direction every 5 minutes. The Voyager, on the other hand, is what's called three-axis stabilized, which is a kind of, they had to call it something, so they came up with that. What it means is, it sits there in space, and it's got little gas jets on board. And every time its sensing equipment detects that it begins to wobble a little bit or to drift a little bit, you fire a gas jet and keep it stabilized that way. Well, that has the advantage that you have a nice stable platform for your imaging. On the other hand, it has the disadvantage that if you want to look in different directions to see the particles and fields, the only way you can do it is by having different detectors pointing in different directions. And there's a limit to the number of directions you can have them pointing. Whereas on the spin-stabilized spacecraft, you're getting, as I say, the whole 360-degree sweep of at least one pointing, see, every 5 minutes. But another respect in which a Voyager is poorer than a Pioneer is that because it keeps firing those gas jets, every time it does that, it changes its trajectory just a little bit. And so you don't get good gravity data because you don't know to as high precision what your trajectory is at any given moment. You keep changing it, and of course it takes a while for the measurements to accumulate to the point where you know what it is. Whereas the Pioneer, Unify those things, it has onboard gas jets in case you need, for example, to change the trajectory a little bit or to change the direction in which it's spinning, or the direction in which it's pointing. But you may go on for months at a time without firing them once. So you have a very, very well-known trajectory. Well, the spacecraft flies past the planet. Its trajectory is, of course, determined by that planet's gravity, which in turn is determined by the distribution of material inside the planet. And so by observing exactly what the trajectory is, with very, very great precision, you can figure out the distribution of material inside the planet, and therefore temperatures and pressures inside the planet, because if you know the distribution of material, you know at a given depth how much gravity there would be, and therefore how much pressure there ought to be if the planet's cold, and if you find that there is less material there, the planet is expanded, then you know that it's hot inside, and so that's how you get, for example, a central temperature of Jupiter that I quoted you. Well, you do that, you can measure the trajectory with extreme precision, and with a Pioneer you can't. There is a little dead zone spacecraft called a transponder. You have this in the Voyager 2, of course, but the Voyager keep changing your path. And the transponder is simply something that hears a radio signal from Earth and sends it right back. So you go beep, and the radio signal travels out there, eventually hits the spacecraft goes beep right back at you. You measure to very great precision, like a millionth of a second, exactly how long it took for the round trip radio travel time to occur. We know the speed at which radio waves travel with extreme precision, because it's the speed of light, 186,282.3960 miles per second. And we can therefore calculate the distance from the Earth to the spacecraft with an error of about 3 feet, a billion miles away. That's how you get this kind of information. And the Pioneers give you better data on that for the reasons I said, and also because, for reasons having to do with the missions of each one, both Pioneers flew closer to both Jupiter and Saturn than either Voyager will, and so got deeper into their gravitational field. You will recall that the interior structure of Jupiter was basically a very, very thin gaseous atmosphere, thinner than this black line that I drew, was the best I could manage for you. Under that, hydrogen compressed, and helium, of course, was mostly hydrogen. The whole planet is mostly hydrogen, so I only bother saying plus helium, et cetera, up here at the top. Under that, a region where the pressure is great enough and has compressed the hydrogen to a liquid, to liquid density, but not yet metallic. Then a huge region of Jupiter, taking up 7/8 of the volume of the planet, which is not only liquid, but compressed to a metal. And finally, at the center, a core about the diameter of the Earth. So that'll give you a scale. That red thing is the size of the Earth. Ignore the black dot. I'm sorry now I put it in. At the time, it seemed like a good idea to show where the center of the planet is. The problem is everybody thinks that it's an inner core. And it's not. It's a black dot that I put in. Confessing my sins, I didn't bother to show the polar flattening. I just drew circles because they're easier to draw. Okay, but of course, both Jupiter and Saturn are flattened at the poles because of their rotation. Both of them spin around about 10 hours, Jupiter a little less than 10, Saturn a little more than 10, and each one is about one Earth diameter less thick through the poles than it is through the equator. So, yeah. You mean the one that I just showed you, the Pioneer 10 one? No way. Otherwise, I'd have to try to convince you the planet is shaped like a top. Because you know the bulges out there? No, that's an artifact of the way the picture was transmitted and hastily reconstructed on the ground. And I guarantee when the... in fact, I'll tell you what the shape of Saturn is, because that was determined from these gravity data as well. Start out with a sphere 74,000 miles in diameter. Okay, that's your first cut. That's your first approximation. To make a better approximation, give it a bulge. Give it a bulge at the equator like so, so that it is thicker through the equator than it is through the poles by a little bit less than one Earth's diameter. And see, I said it wrong, but you're drilling the diameter through the equator after you've added that bulge to 74,000 miles. Now to do an even better job, scoop away a very broad, shallow trough that extends all the way around the planet, like so, at this latitude, centered on about 40 degrees north, in other words, about the same latitude as we are here on the Earth, and the trough should be 600 feet deep, okay, and of course, you know, tens of thousands of miles wide. Similar trough in the southern hemisphere. And I say, wait a minute, what possibly maintains those troughs? You know, it's a liquid planet, just the same as Jupiter is, and you think it would simply flow into a spherical shape, or if it's spinning that fast, flow into a shape that bulges at the equator. It turns out that because it would flow into a shape that bulges at the equator, its gravitational field is distorted in such a way as you can maintain that trough in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. All of this, I'm sure, is absolutely brand new to most of you, but it is not brand new to scientists. It's been known since... well before the turn of the century, that when you go through the equations for the gravitational field of a liquid body which is held together by self-gravitation, you can have features like this. Basically, you can describe the shape of a planet by doing a series of manipulations like this. In other words, you start out with a circle, and that's the biggest thing, okay? Everything else is going to be a minor modification of the circle. The next thing you do is give it, superimpose on that circle a shape that has one bulge on each side. Okay, that's the bulge at the equator. And those bulges are small compared to the radius of the sphere. Now to do a better approximation, superimpose on that one bulge shape a shape that has two bulges on each side. I described the trough, but if you think about what's between the trough, you can think of this as a shape that has two bulges on each side. If I exaggerate it, if I made it thousands, tens of thousands of miles high instead of only a few hundred feet high, then there would be an additional bulge at the equator, but then the depression in the northern latitude, bulge at the North Pole, depression, bulge. So you see how it looks sort of like a cross, except that it's rounded off, okay? And it has four bulges. Now superimpose on that the shape you've got up to this point, an even smaller additional approximation, which has six bulges as you go around. Okay, the last one had four. Then superimpose on that a still smaller one. Now you're probably talking about bulges a few feet high that have eight bulges as you go all the way around. And then 10, 12, so forth. Even numbers only for a liquid planet. For a solid planet, which has three, you include all the odd numbers as well. And so, if this were a solid planet, actually this would be a possible shape, except that it is grossly too large. This is the three-bulge version, right? Superimposed on top of the sphere. By sheer accident, the computer, the picture happened to come out that way. And the reason I'm going through all this is that some of you are probably still laboring under a misapprehension that goes back to the
very early 1960s. We knew, although we'd known ever since the time of Newton, or maybe a little bit later, the first two components of the shape of the Earth. That is, we knew its diameter. That was discovered by Eratosthenes around 240 BC, with an error of only a few percent. So he discovered the first component, that he measured its size. Newton, or somebody shortly after Newton, I'm not too good on this history, measured the second component, the two-bulge component, in other words, how flattened the Earth is at the equator. Much, much less flattened in proportion with Jupiter or Saturn. Jupiter and Saturn are both almost 10% thicker through the equator than through the pole, with the Earth being 1/3 of 1% greater. And if you look at a picture of the Earth taken from space, a full Earth picture, you can't see any Jupiter bulge at all. As far as you can tell with the eye, it's a perfect sphere. But it can be measured gravitationally. Vanguard 1, one of the earliest U.S. satellites, laughed at its time because of the size of a grapefruit and weighed 3.25 pounds. But it was the world's first solar-powered satellite. And so it didn't shut up after a couple of days or weeks, as the other earlier satellites had that were all powered by batteries. Furthermore, it was the first one to go into a really high orbit, 2,000 miles out. And so it kept transmitting and transmitting year after year after year after year, and it is. The irony is, it was the one that everybody laughed at. It was the fruit of the Vanguard program, which had had all those disastrous failures, just as the Russians were beginning to launch their first Sputnik. You know, everybody was laughing at poor Vanguard. And the height of the insult seemed to be the first satellite launched was a little bitty breakthrough-sized test sphere. But the irony is, that is by far the oldest satellite still in orbit. It won't come down for thousands of years. Which is to say that another 10 years or so, somebody's going to fly a space shuttle out and take it up for the Smithsonian Air Space Museum. So, Vanguard 1 just kept transmitting, you know. And in fact, it got to the point where it was really a pain after a while, because the only instrument it had on board was a thermometer. And after 8 years, absolutely nobody cared what its temperature was. You know, we had so much more sophisticated satellites up by then, that the doggone thing was cluttering up an entire radio frequency that couldn't be used for anything else, sending back an utterly useless data about its temperature. But, and in fact, as a result of that experience, all satellites since have been equipped with cutoff switches, so they can be able to shut up. And in fact, the first one of those, I think it was satellite was put on, I think it was 4 or 6, but I don't want to swear to that, and the switch didn't work. So it kept transmitting anyway, you know, and the satellite wouldn't shut up and so forth. But the point is, it's because it transmitted for so long, it was possible to track it in orbit with unheard of accuracy for those days. And it discovered the third component of the Earth's shape. And if you think about that shape for a moment, it has three bulges, and so it looks sort of like a pear. See that? Okay. If you exaggerate, the bulges are only a few tens of feet high. But if you exaggerate to make them, you know, 100,000 miles high, the way you have to be able to show them like this, it looks as though it looks like a pear. Well, you can imagine what the reporters did when they got a hold of it. They did not understand this thing about components and adding them all together, and the fact that this is only the third in an endless series of components, each one of which is smaller than the ones before. And so what they reported was, the Earth isn't really round, it's pear-shaped. And to this day, a lot of people, you know, back in the news media, we're still covering space. And to this day, a lot of people have not been told what the true situation was. And so I figured, as long as we got into the shape of Jupiter and Saturn, I might as well bring that one up, too. Well, it turns out, when you go through the equation, that the second component, the one with the two bulges, distorts the planet's gravity in such a way as to allow the existence of the four-bulge component, which in turn distorts the planet's gravity enough to allow the existence of the six-fold component, and so on up forever and ever, except that each one gets smaller and smaller, and eventually gets to the point where you're talking about something 2 millimeters high, and it becomes ridiculous. But basically, that's what allows these things. And on a liquid planet, only the ones with even number of bulges can occur because of the symmetrical arrangement of gravity. But on a solid planet, which has structural strength, it can support the odd number of components as well. Hence, you have a pear-shaped component of the Earth. Somebody said Jim a while ago.
Yeah. I want to get back to the cameras that they're using. Is anything like the
Viking? Yeah, rather similar. Except that there, the spacecraft wasn't spinning, so you had to have a mechanical action. It's not the same camera, but it's the same it's the same in the sense that he doesn't have very good resolution, and it keeps painting one line at a time and takes a long time to take an image. What's much closer to, in fact, the same camera, is the one used on the ATS satellites, which I'm sure you're familiar with because I know who you are. They're placed in geosynchronous orbits at a height above the Earth where they revolve around once every 24 hours, so the spacecraft always stays directly above the same place on the Earth. And ATS-1 had a camera like that that was black and white and gave what to this day most people think was the first picture ever taken of the Earth that shows it as a disk, you know, from far enough out as you can see essentially the entire hemisphere. Actually, that's not true. The Russians had done that before, and we had done it even earlier with a spacecraft called Dodge that absolutely nobody ever heard of. Department of Defense Gravity Experiment is what Dodge stands for, but it had a camera to monitor spacecraft function, but it was pointing at the Earth, and that was the first one, our first one. And ATS-3 had a color camera, and you can go buy a poster, you know, a lot of poster shops that has an ATS-3 picture of the Earth, and I think it says Love Your Mother, which was kind of nice. You know, guy has it hanging in the office. So that's the camera, the same camera. And it's similar to the camera on the Pioneer Venus orbiter.
Well, yeah.
The reason I asked, and I'm trying to get the thing up, you know, the lighting problem I have is going back and forth, but you can't, there's something that in front of
it. Yeah.
You wouldn't pick it up.
Right. There's no question that the pictures of both Venus from Pioneer Venus 1 and Jupiter and Saturn from Pioneers 10, in the case of Saturn 11, are distorted, just the way you're talking about. But it doesn't matter all that much, because you usually don't especially care. Well, let's take ATS 1 or 3, which has the same problem. You usually don't care that you're photographing North America at a slightly different time than South America, because the weather in North America doesn't affect the weather in South America over a time scale that is as short as it takes to go from the one to the other. So it doesn't especially matter that you image one a little bit earlier than you image the other. And same thing with these planets. But if you had some really rapid event on the planet, no reason to assume you do. Certainly the Voyager planet pictures give you no hint that you do. It would in fact be distorted, yeah. But, you know, there is a problem. So it's a fair compromise. But I want to emphasize, the pioneers are not primarily intended to take pictures. They're primarily intended to get particles and field data, to get gravity data, and to scout the way for the voyagers. So it's really kind of unfair to go into very elaborate criticisms of their pictures. It would be just as unfair if I stood up here and went into long criticisms of Voyager particles and field data. You know, different spacecraft do different things better, and that's why we send out more than one. That's one reason. Another reason is that planets change over time. Okay, inside Saturn, you've got some major similarities and some major differences. First of all, Saturn is almost the same size as Jupiter. You know what I'm saying? And that I have drawn correctly in the sense that the diameter of the circles that I use is the actual equatorial diameter of both planets. Saturn's diameter is 74,000 miles at the equator. Jupiter's is 86,500. That is truly remarkable, because Jupiter is over three times as heavy as Saturn. So you'd think it would be three times as big. It's not. It's almost the same size. Well, the reason for it turns out to be really kind of neat. Hydrogen, especially, is an extremely compressible substance. That is to say, you can squeeze it a lot. And, you know, throw a Charmin. And if you have a planet that is made mostly of hydrogen, like Saturn, and you decided to send a flock of spacecraft out there and pour in a whole lot more hydrogen and make it into a Jupiter. Well, what happened is, as you poured in more and more and more and more, more hydrogen, it would get a little bit bigger, but mostly what would happen is the gravity would become greater and greater since there's more material and it would just squeeze itself more. And so the size would change very, very little throughout a large range. Obviously, the point comes where, you know, if you have a pound of hydrogen, it's not the size of Jupiter or Saturn. But over a large range of possible masses there, masses of how big the planet is, it is in fact just about the same. And in fact, Jupiter is almost as big as a cold object, cold compared to a star, can get. Jupiter is cold compared to a star. It's not millions of degrees inside. Another way to put that would be Jupiter is about as large as an object that is made of solids or liquids, as opposed to gases like a star, can ever get. If you try to make Jupiter bigger,
you would find that it would get slightly bigger, very, very slightly bigger, as you poured on more and more material, until finally you reached a maximum when you had an object about 10 times as heavy as Jupiter. And then, a very interesting thing would happen. At the center, first, and then at a larger and larger region as you poured on still more material, the pressure would become so great that the very atoms would become crushed into one another. It's a thing called degenerate matter. That is not a comment on its moral, it's a mathematical technical term. And the effect would be, believe it or not, that after you reach this critical size, namely 10 times as heavy as Jupiter, but almost the same size as Jupiter, only a tiny bit bigger, as soon as degeneracy sets in, if you add still more material, it begins to become smaller. Try to imagine that. If you have two rocks, one of them twice as heavy as the other, you expect one to be twice as heavy as the other. I'm saying if you have two degenerate bodies, one of them twice as heavy as the other, the bigger, the heavier one is smaller. And the reason for that is that as you add on more and more material, the pressure gets greater and greater, degeneracy occurs over a larger and larger fraction of the body, and the result is, and degenerate matter is very, very compact. Typical density for degenerate matter is several tons per cubic centimeter. A cubic centimeter is a thimbleful. And water is, by definition, 1 gram per cubic centimeter. Iron is about 5 grams per cubic centimeter. If there are any Edgar Varese fans in the crowd, you know that the platinum is 21.5. Actually, the best current value is 21.7 grams per cubic centimeter. We're talking about tons per cubic centimeter. Well, all this is not theory. It happens when a star, a large, gaseous, high object, finally runs out of fuel, as any star must, eventually. And then it becomes smaller, and it becomes cold, and it becomes solid, and it becomes a degenerate body. So, if you have a dead star that is, for example, as a dead sun will be, or more accurately, a star as heavy as the sun is now. Actually, stars lose some material, they boil it off their outside in their old age. But if you have a dead star that is as heavy as the sun, which is to say, 1,000 times as heavy as Jupiter, or 250,000 times as heavy as the Earth, it would only be 3 times the diameter of the Earth, about like that. Much smaller than Jupiter. And it doesn't stop there. If you keep pouring on more and more material, the thing gets smaller and smaller and smaller, until finally, when you reach a number that is not too well known, but is no more than 3 times as heavy as a dead star as heavy as the sun, which is to say about 1,000,000 times as heavy as the Earth, or 3,000 times as heavy as Jupiter, the dead star has collapsed to a geometric point. And that is a black hole. So it turns out, incredibly enough, that one of the best ways to introduce to people what a black hole is to start out by discussing the interior composition of Jupiter and Saturn. And so you get that as kind of a little extra bonus for having taken this lecture series. Strictly speaking, the black hole is not the name given to the total collapsed star. It is the name given to the region of space around it, within which its gravity is so intense that nothing, including light, can escape from it. In other words, if this totally collapsed point of matter could emit light, and I refuse to speculate about whether it could, the light would get up to a certain height, turn around, and dive back into the dead star. And if light can't escape, neither can anything else, because nothing can travel faster than light. So, presumably, so that's what I call black. You see, light cannot escape from it. And, well, okay. Now, I'm not going to take any questions about black holes, because we don't have time to have black holes lecture. But in this particular point lends itself so nicely to at least introducing him that I couldn't pass up the opportunity. Another very interesting paradox, and that is you will notice that the cores of both planets, Jupiter and Saturn, from the time of gravity data, of course this is preliminary, but it's not going to change much. I'd be willing to bet that it won't change enough that if I could show you the final version of this slide, you'd be able to see the difference with your eye. The core is the same size. Furthermore, it's about as heavy. In both cases, the core is believed to be about 3 times as heavy as the Earth, molten rock and metal. Well, you know, I told you that a Jovian planet was one whose gravity was great enough that it was able to suck in even the gases in the solar nebula around it, even the hydrogen and helium. So it's a very interesting situation. How does it happen that you have three core bodies, two core bodies rather, both of them about the same size, both of them about as heavy, about three times heavy as the Earth. Of course, then they were three times the volume of the Earth, but now the compression has gotten down to where they're each about the size of the Earth. And how come one of them was able to grab over three times as much hydrogen and helium as the other to form the Vulcan Jovian planet? And we never really know the answer. I'll give you an arm-waving possibility without claiming that it's the only possible answer. The gas cloud the solar system formed from, out where Saturn formed, was probably less dense than where it was in close to the sun. You know, the sun probably concentrated the gas cloud toward the sun by gravity. And so it may have been less dense out where Saturn was. And what that means is the protoplanet, the growing body, can only pull in material from the cloud around it out to the distance where its own gravity is greater than the gravity of the sun. And so there may have simply been a smaller amount of hydrogen helium available to the growing Saturn within that radius than there was available to the growing Jupiter.
But in that argument, the original Earth is almost
about
heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
Units that were much
heavier. Right. Should have been even bigger, but also near the sun it was a great deal hotter. And we don't know this for sure. I mean, it may be, it's only coincidence that there happened to be Jovian planets only in the outer solar system. But a lot of people sort of take for granted without thinking about it too much that that is not coincidence, and that the reason is that it was so much hotter in where the Earth was that it was simply, the hydrogen and helium were so hot that even that much gravity was not able to pull them in. Or it may be two. You said almost as heavy as zero. You do have a factor of three here. That may have been enough to make the difference. It may have been fairly critical. It's certainly interesting to me, you know, there's no terrestrial planet that's heavier than the Earth. And it's certainly interesting to me how these terrestrial cores in these Jovian planets are not very much heavier than the Earth, but they are heavier. It makes you wonder if maybe the temperature argument isn't relevant and there is some critical level there. And you got to remember, if you are heavy enough that you can pull in hydrogen and helium, automatically you go a totally different route than if you're not, because there is so much more hydrogen and helium in the universe than everything else. So if you can pull it in at all, you're going to be a totally different kind of planet. So, you know, any or all of the above may be true. Okay, the other thing that is different here, as you see, is something that has happened inside Saturn, has not happened inside Jupiter, and that is, do you remember what are the next most abundant materials in Jupiter and Saturn after hydrogen and helium? Water, methane, and ammonia, right? Which are respectively the compound of hydrogen with oxygen to form water, carbon to form methane, nitrogen to form ammonia. It is colder inside Saturn than it is inside Jupiter for the simple reason that it is a smaller planet and a less heavy planet. I'm sorry, less heavy is the operative phrase. Therefore, when it fell together 4.5 billion years ago, it did not generate nearly as much friction as Jupiter did. And indeed, Saturn is. We have temperature measurements inside of these gravity data, and I'll get to those in a moment. But it's not as heavy as, it's not as hot as inside Jupiter. It's roughly, this is a very crude preliminary figure, a quarter as hot as inside Jupiter. The result of that is there is less convection. There is less thermally generated motion of the wicklow. And what that means is that something has been able to happen inside Saturn that was not able to happen inside Jupiter, namely, these substances, water, methane, and ammonia, all of which are denser than hydrogen and helium, were able to separate out and fall in toward the center. You know, the rock was able to do that in Jupiter, but the methane, ammonia, and water weren't. They aren't all that much dense with hydrogen and helium, and there's enough heat inside Jupiter to keep them stirred together. Well, as they fall in there, the pressure is so enormous that it breaks up the molecules, strips away the hydrogen. The hydrogen, of course, then immediately bobs back up to the surface, immediately by this time scale that we're talking about here. And so what you have is an outer core that is 9 times as heavy as the Earth and extends out to about a quarter of the radius of the planet, 23% is the latest value, that is made of oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen that came from the decomposition of the water, methane, and ammonia. By the way, a lot of the reports you may read, even Science News, which is usually scrupulously accurate, say that this outer core is made of water, methane, and ammonia, because unfortunately the scientists chose to present it that way. And you really had to kind of dig it out of them. And in fact, what they were talking about was oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen from the decomposition of those substances. Maybe the scientists felt that the reporters, you know, wouldn't be able to understand it if they got that detailed about it. But, I mean, you know, there were two kinds of reporters out there. There were the guys like me that wanted everything, or the guys like John Everhart at Science News, and, you know, were fairly capable of thinking until we understand these things. And then there were the ones who wanted 30 seconds worth on the TV evening news, and they were not going to report this at all. You know, so it was not really a very good way to do it. But in any case, metallic oxygen, which is the most abundant of the three, forms a metal at a pressure even below the one where hydrogen forms a metal. Hydrogen forms a metal at about 3 million Earth atmospheres pressure. In other words, 3 million times the 14.7 pounds per square inch that is sitting on you right now. Oxygen does it at only half a million Earth atmospheres. So I guarantee that outer core is metallic. Okay, finally the internal heat of Saturn. Jupiter emits 2.5 times as much heat as it receives from the Sun. That can all be explained in terms of the heat left over from the origin. You do the numbers, you do the calculations, it works out right. It's reasonable for Jupiter to have retained enough heat since it originated. We can estimate roughly how much heat was generated when it fell together. We can estimate roughly how fast it would lose it. And it's reasonable for Jupiter to be emitting that much heat from inside itself just from leftover heat formation. By an interesting little coincidence, Pioneer 11 finds that Saturn is also emitting 2.5 times as much heat as it receives from the Sun. Now, of course, Saturn receives only a quarter as much heat from the Sun as Jupiter does, okay? Which is why I said that, crudely, Saturn's temperature inside is only a quarter as great. But the important thing is that Saturn is less than a third as heavy as Jupiter. It generated much less heat when it formed. And what that means is that you cannot explain, even with a lesser amount of heat than for Jupiter, you cannot explain it as exclusively leftover heat of formation. So you need to find an additional mechanism which will work inside Saturn but won't work inside Jupiter and that generates the extra heat for Saturn. One such mechanism was proposed by James Pollock, who is a planetary scientist at Ames Research Center, where they fly the Pioneers. He says that inside Saturn, the temperature is low enough that not only will the water, methane, and ammonia settle out, but very, very slowly and very, very slightly, the helium will separate out from the hydrogen. It's not a rapid event for several reasons. First of all, helium and hydrogen are not immiscible liquids the way, for example, oil and vinegar are. You know, you take a bottle of oil and vinegar and they separate out by weight. And the reason for that is you cannot mix them with one another, like oil and water. Okay, they separate totally. When you give them a chance to separate it all, they separate them cleanly. Hydrogen, helium, when they're liquid, are not that way. Secondly, there isn't all that much difference in density between them when you squeeze them as much as they're squeezed inside Jupiter or Saturn. But Pollock calculates that very slowly and partially they would in fact tend to separate out. And this has been going on for about a billion years. They're totally miscible up until the point when the planet is cooled below a certain temperature. That temperature is 10,000 kelvins, which is about, we'll call it 18,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Jupiter has not reached that temperature yet. Saturn reached it about a billion years ago. And so for the last billion years, according to Pollock, the helium has been very slowly settling out. As it does so, of course, since it is moving, it is generating friction as it passes through the material around it, and he calculates that can produce enough additional heat to explain the observed heat excess on Saturn. Yeah? Well, you don't mean reflected heat. Well, actually, okay, I'm sorry. None of it. The sunlight hits the planet, a certain percentage is reflected back by the clouds, and we ignore that in doing the calculations. What I'm saying is that both Jupiter and Saturn emit into space 2.5 times as much heat as they absorb from the Sun. And the amount they absorb from the Sun is the percentage that their clouds don't reflect back into space, which in both cases is, 25-30%, something like that. They're not quite as reflective as Venus, and Venus is 80% reflective. So, you know, if I say 30%, it would be close. saw several hands there. Hands is not the best way.
What about radioactivity?
I asked that. Radioactivity is minor just because, you know, take Jupiter. You got 3 times the mass of the Earth in there. You got 300 times the mass of the Earth out here. And a very tiny fraction of that mass is radioactive. In fact, I can give you the number for the Earth. The Earth emits into space a heat excess because of the radioactivity that beats it inside. But that heat excess is only 1/3 of 1% of what it gets because it's reabsorbed solar radiation, reemitted solar radiation. So it would be a comparable kind of number. You want to get it up to a slightly higher amount because A, there's less sunlight that hits out here, and B, you got more material go right ahead. It's going to be negligible compared to the ones we were talking about. And I saw some other hands today. Okay,
well, let's go on then.
Let me introduce you to the rings of Saturn. You already know some things about them. For example, they're very, very thin. Jim Boyan's computer graphics show very accurately how they virtually disappear. They just become an extremely thin line. You see them edge on. And we do see them at various angles from the Earth. As a matter of fact, we are going to see them edge on like this later this month. In October 29th, to be exact, they will first become edge on as seen from the Earth. And that will be the first time they did so since 1966. And now, of course, there's a lot more interest in Saturn among astronomers than there was in 1966. We should get some very, very interesting observations, not so much about Saturn as about the rings and any small moons that may be in right next to the rings. The last time they were edge-on, some French astronomers, Dollfuss and some other people, claimed to have discovered a small moon, which they gave the name Janus, right outside the rings. And some people say, you know, they've got this thin line, which is the rings, and there's a little blob here. And some people say, no, that's just a bright light from the rings. And some people say, no, it's definitely a moon. And some people say that if you look at a whole bunch of the pictures that were taken then, and unfortunately not a lot of them were taken, you can see several different moons. And they can't all be the same object in different places in its orbit. You can't fit in orbit to all of them. Periods don't work. So, you know, we ought to have that settled within the next few weeks. And a lot of fancy astronomical technology has been developed since 1966 that we can now bring to bear on this purpose. But the main thing that I wanted to show you is how thin the rings are and the fact that there are different rings. And let's introduce you to these rings by name, the A ring. Then there is a gap several thousand miles wide called Cassini's division after the guy discovered it back in 1700. Then is the brightest and widest of the rings, which is to say the densest of the rings, and that is the B ring. You understand what I mean when I say the densest because it's the brightest? By densest, I mean number of ring particles per cubic foot of space, a cubic mile of space. And the more they reflect the sun, the more dense they have to be. Then there's the C ring, or crepe ring. Crepe is in crepe paper, because it's quite dull. And in fact, in this picture, you can't see it at all out here, but you can see where it's silhouetted against the planet. See the crepe ring there? And that would extend around in there, as you can see it outside in this picture. And then there is the Garand gap, and there's the D ring. Something that has been argued for a long time.